Okay, Norwegian political scientist Stein Rokken once said, under capitalism, votes count, but resources decide. I think that that's a pretty good starting point for us here today. Because under capitalism, it's not only money, but also political power, which is concentrated amongst the rich and powerful in our society. It's those with resources who are able to dictate policy to parliamentarians. It's those with resources who parliamentarians rely on for their corporate donations and campaign coffers. And it's those with resources who are able to create all hell if they withdraw their money from a country. And this leads to quite a cozy relationship between parliamentarians of all sides, including those of the Labor Party and the Greens, and capitalists. A cozy relationship that both sides are loath to break. Now, what I'll be discussing today is, firstly, what Parliament actually represents under capitalism, and secondly, what this means in practice for the Labor Party and the Greens. So what does Parliament actually represent under capitalism? A British socialist once wrote, "One man, one vote is, apparently, the be-all and end-all of democracy. But one man may own 6 newspapers, 2 television stations and 6 factories. Another man may earn £20 a week, £7 of which goes in rent and £13 of which has to make do for his family. Each one has one vote, but are they equally represented in society?" Now, it should come as no surprise that wealth easily leads to political influence. In the financial year 2004 to 2005, corporate donations to the Labor and Liberal parties was in excess of $130 million. And no one pretends that this situation is anything other than you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. For example, in 2002 to 2003, ethanol company, Australian ethanol company Manildra, dramatically increased its political donations to all the major political parties in Australia. Almost immediately afterwards, the government slapped a 38.5-cent excise on Manildra's ethanol importing competitors. Money also gains access to policymakers. As Justin Dart, a chair of the American company Port Industries, once said, "Talking to politicians is fine, but with a little money, they hear you better." So for you and I, if we have an issue with, say, the government's education policy, we could write a letter of complaint. If lucky, we may get a politely worded form letter back in return. But if we're on the board of a major education business, though, we could pay for a seat at the dinner table of the education minister to discuss those grievances personally. And this is what the head of Melbourne University Private did when he paid $3,500 for a table at an ALP fundraiser recently. When asked why, he said, "It's an opportunity to talk to people in an informal context. It's about influence. It's about finding out what they're thinking. It's about them finding out what we're thinking." I struggle to see anything subversive in that. But it's not just this direct access to policymakers that mean that Parliament acts in their interests. The key reason is that the goals of business, rapid economic growth, high profits and secure markets are also the goals of government. As Michael Parenti in his book Democracy for the Few put it, "Because business controls the very economy of the nation, government perforce enters into a unique and intimate relationship with it. The health of the capitalist economy is treated by policymakers as a necessary condition for the health of the nation. And since it happens that the economy is in the hands of the large investors, then presumably government services to the public is best accomplished by service to the investors." And I think if you think about the recent parental leave debate in this country, I think that's a pretty good example. The government's absolute outrage at the mere suggestion that big business in this country could pay even a slightly higher tax rate in order to fund something as, you know, seemingly obvious as parental leave. It was just absolutely astounding, the rhetoric from the government against this suggestion. And any elected representative who thinks that their key focus isn't the interests of the rich and powerful in this society gets a quick lesson in capitalist democracy. As the Polish revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg pointed out in her classic study, Reform or Revolution, as soon as democracy shows the tendency to negate its class character and become transformed into an instrument of the real interests of the population, the democratic forms are sacrificed by the ruling class and by its state representatives. Now, the 1975 sacking of the Whitlam government here in Australia was an example of precisely this. The bosses thought that the Liberal leader Fraser would be better placed to stick the boot into workers as a worldwide recession started to hit Australia. Even the vicious austerity budget that Whitlam brought down failed to satisfy them, so they orchestrated his dismissal. And the sacking provoked a spontaneous protest by millions of Australian workers that actually came close to rescuing Whitlam. Yet the response of the ALP to the coup illustrated that their commitment to parliamentary democracy is really a commitment to the efficient running of capitalism. Labor Party officials and union leaders argued for workers to cool it, to return to work and wait passively for the election. They were alarmed at the scale of workers' protest, which posed a threat to the peaceful day-to-day running of Australian capitalism. Now, the fact that Parliament itself represents the interests of business and capitalism first and foremost provides an important straitjacket for parliamentarians. It doesn't matter how good the intentions of those who go into Parliament are. It doesn't matter how much they would like to change the world. If those ideas and ideals conflict with the interests of the capitalist class, they'll be forced at best to compromise, and at worst, they'll be forced off the scene altogether, as the Whitlam dismissal shows. Now, 20 years ago, Peter Garrett, as the front man for Midnight Oil, was singing about opposing uranium mining and not wanting to sell his soul. Nowadays, not only is he approving those uranium mines himself, but he's practically the poster boy for Souls R Us. Now, some parties are more explicit about accepting these terms than others. The current Labor government, for example, is clear about which side of the class divide it stands on. Think about work choices. Now, as we all know, the Liberals lost the last election because work choices was so vastly unpopular that the majority of the working class voted for the Labor Party. And they did this in the belief that the ALP would actually repeal these laws. And yet, when it came to the crunch, the ALP has kept on the books many significant aspects of work choices, including some of the most anti-worker elements, including the Australian Building and Construction Commission, which is basically, you know, the bully boys whose sole job is to stop construction workers from defending their rights and conditions against things like, you know, asbestos on their work site. Now, the ALP has done this despite the unpopularity of work choices, despite the mandate from the majority to get rid of work choices in its entirety, because at the end of the day, it's in the interests of the capitalist class to keep these anti-worker laws. And it's those interests that the ALP is chiefly concerned about, not the interests of the majority. And so, for the most part, work choices will stay on the books under the slightly more palatable name of Fair Work Australia. Now, defenders of the ALP would have us believe that it's only the current lack of principles in the party that have led to this situation, and that if we look at the history of the party, we can look back to a golden age of Labourism in this country. But when we actually look at that history, while we can see a hell of a lot of gold, there's not so much of a golden age. Throughout their history, the ALP has always followed the capitalist economic orthodoxies at the time in order to foster the profits of the capitalist class. So, after Federation, both Labor and the Conservatives shared a common program of tariff protection to foster the development of manufacturing industry. During the Depression of the 1930s, the ALP split and the federal and New South Wales governments fell. However, all of the Labor administrations at the time, including Jack Lang's in New South Wales, which was far and away the most radical ALP government that we've ever seen in this country, even that government agreed to policies of cutting back on workers' living conditions so as to cover budget deficits. In the 1930s and 40s, Keynesianism became the orthodoxy of the economics profession, and Labor embraced that too. As the Australian economy became increasingly integrated into the world economy in the 1960s and 70s, the Whitlam government cut tariffs to once again foster Australian business interests. The government of Hawke and Keating embraced neoliberalism with a vengeance, privatising anything that wasn't nailed down and deregulating huge sections of the economy. But it's not just the ALP who want to maintain their comfortable relationship with business. The Greens too, for all of their left-wing rhetoric, are quite happy to get into bed with business. And I think that the recent Tasmanian elections provide a pretty good example of this. And I think that many people on the left are shocked that the Greens would even consider the possibility of supporting a coalition government with the Liberal Party, or even an accord as they're currently talking about in Tasmania. We don't expect the supposedly radical Greens would support the avowed party of big business. And when you think about it, it's like Harry Potter doing a deal with Voldemort. But actually, when you look at the way that the Greens ran the recent Tasmanian elections, it's not in any way surprising. And in fact, it fits entirely with the thesis that it's first and foremost the interests of the capitalist class that parliamentary parties are concerned with. Throughout the campaign, the Greens were constantly at pains to assure investors and the media that they are above all concerned to maintain parliamentary stability and promote business confidence. An article in The Age before the election talked of how proud Nick McKim, the Tasmanian Greens leader, was for propping up business interests on the island. And McKim even declared his willingness to enter into private negotiations with both Labor and Liberal without any preconditions, meaning that he's prepared to ditch any or all of the Greens' policies. He said, "No party can expect to get all of its policies through the Parliament. Our hand remains extended to both Labor leader David Bartlett and Liberal leader Will Hodgman. We want to work constructively with either or both of these people." Now, once again, we can't excuse this behaviour. McKim is not some renegade pro-capitalist in the Greens. On the contrary, Bob Brown has indicated that McKim is a clear candidate to take over the leadership of the party. And in The Age, just today, I haven't yet read the article which a comrade kindly gave to me before the break, and I just didn't get a chance to have a look at it. But it seems as though the article is basically saying that the Victorian Greens in the upcoming state election will pretty much be taking, you know, leaves of the pages straight out of the book of what the Tasmanian Greens did in the upcoming Victorian state elections as well. And it's actually fairly consistent behaviour of the Greens to abandon left-wing policies when they hold the balance of power. Greens members of the ACT Legislative Assembly helped the Liberals form government in 1995 and backed elements of their savage privatisation program, which included the privatisation of Jindalee Nursing Home, with one Greens member of the Legislative Assembly saying, "Corporatisation is not necessarily a bad thing. We felt that the Liberal Party deserved to go." Huh. So there's nothing consistently anti-big business about the Greens, let alone anti-capitalist. But if we were to leave the story there, then we would, just merely looking at the relationship between these parties and the capitalists, we would be telling only half the story. Because at the same time as these parties have to defend the interests and, most importantly, the profits of the ruling class, they also have a support base outside of that class which they have to keep on side. And so there is, at least to some extent, a need for these parties to balance these competing interests. And it's this that differentiates these two parties from the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party is the explicitly pro-ruling class party whose key constituency is in the ruling and upper middle classes. While it can occasionally get votes from certain sections of the working class, this class doesn't form its core basis. As a song by Australian folk singer Alastair Hewlett says, a vote for Labour only means I did not vote for that rich prick in a Ferrari. So the ALP, whilst being committed to running the capitalist system, do have a support base in the working class and has an organisational structure which is heavily dependent on the trade unions. This was most evident in the 2007 election, once again, with Labour so clearly making work choices the issue of the election. Even though the ALP's policy was never to actually redress the problems of work choices, the rhetoric they employed was clearly designed to restore the credibility of the party amongst its core constituency, the much vaunted working families that we heard so much about, who had become increasingly cynical about the Labour Party. The paid officials of the trade unions, the union bureaucracy, play a very significant role for Labour. The ALP gets funding from trade unions, and trade unions still have significant voting rights in the party at internal conferences. Furthermore, many ALP politicians get pre-selected by the party after a stint in the union bureaucracy. And this begins to explain why the majority of the working class, however grudgingly at times, looks to the ALP. Not because they're duped by the party's rhetoric, but because there's still some connection between the party and the organised working class, even though that connection is fraying more and more over time. Despite its long record of betraying workers' interests, many workers still look to the ALP as being in some sense their party, as opposed to the boss's party, the Liberals. And this working class identification with Labour is much weaker today than it was a generation or two ago when many more workers were actually ALP members. But once again, we shouldn't be fooled by those who want to claim the past as the ALP's golden age. For example, one of the things that is usually presented as the idea that in the past the ALP has been a party of the workers is the reforms of the Whitlam government. And yet, most of the Whitlam government's reform agenda was no more than the government of the day being forced to put into law many of the gains workers had won by direct action themselves, such as longer paid holidays and equal pay for women. Many of his reforms fitted perfectly with the needs of a modernising economy. So the introduction of free higher education was as much about the needs of the capitalist class to have a better educated workforce as anything else. And also, his reforms were frequently much more limited than the myths often suggest. For example, Whitlam's government formally scrapped the White Australia policy, but it cut back the number of migrants at the same time and launched a vicious and racist assault against Vietnamese refugees. As Whitlam himself said, nothing could be further from the truth that we are anti-business or hostile to business. So even the figure that is most lauded as the most left-wing leader of the ALP was not firmly on the side of the working class. Nevertheless, many workers still hope that things will somehow be better under a Labor government, though obviously after the experience of the Rudd government, that hope is few and far between. While others will vote for the ALP with gritted teeth because they're determined not to vote for the open party of big business, the Liberals. Now, the Greens, on the other hand, don't have any formal ties to the working class. The Greens' leadership comes mainly from a middle-class background. Bob Brown was a doctor, Nick McKim an advertising executive. And their support base is mainly young people who are either students or have recently finished tertiary education. Now, this support base means that they have no reason to consistently stand up for the rights of the working class. And this helps to explain why they can so easily slip into policies which are so clearly in the interests of big business, such as privatisation. The Greens often take political positions which reflect what is happening in society at the time. For example, the Greens really made their mark on federal politics in the 2001 election. This is the so-called Tampa election, where both Labor and Liberal parties targeted refugees in order to gain votes. Now, the Greens reflected a genuine, if minority, left-wing concern of support for refugees. And this was being articulated by protests out on the streets and indeed in the refugee detention centres themselves. The Greens' support for refugees in that election was what turned them into a serious alternative party on the federal stage. However, since Rudd has taken office, they've been almost silent on the many aspects of Rudd's refugee policy which have come straight out of the Howard era. And similarly, since the election, we've barely heard a peep out of the Greens on questions such as work choices. It's when there are political campaigns happening which radicalise their support base that the Greens take left-wing positions on these sorts of issues. However, the natural tendency for all parliamentary parties is to ensure their comfortable relationship with the ruling class. Therefore, in the absence of major political campaigns, the Greens fall silent on left-wing issues. I think a good example of this is the Greens' attitude towards war and imperialism. The Greens have over the past few years, been seen as the anti-war party. However, their commitment to anti-war ideas has always been equivocal. Bob Brown made a revealing statement at a Sydney rally against the Iraq War in 2003 when he said, "No matter what, this is George Bush's war. This is not Australia's war." In other words, the Greens' opposition to war is not derived from opposition to US imperialism, but from an estimation that it's not in Australia's national interest. I guess in the terminology of the conference over the weekend, they're not knee-jerk anti-imperialists. So the clear implication is that if these wars were in Australia's national interest, then the Greens would support it. But considering that the term national interest is always used as a synonym for Australian business interests, this has to be a concern. By putting the Australian national interest front and centre, the Greens end up accepting the Australia-US alliance and all that that entails. And this leads to an equivocation when it comes to condemning every US military adventure. After all, Bob Brown thinks that Australia should do all it can to maintain its historically close and friendly ties with the American government. And this is part of the reason why the New South Wales Greens recently refused to endorse an anti-war demonstration held in Sydney. This protest was held to coincide with Obama's expected visit to Australia. This apparently was too much for the Greens. Holding Obama responsible for the wars which he commands is apparently what led the New South Wales Greens at their most recent state delegates conference to refuse to support the Iraq anniversary rally. Greens MPs had been invited but declined, and only a couple of individual Greens members attended the rally. The Greens' support for the national interest also blinds them to the imperialism of the Australian ruling class. "Australian troops," says Bob Brown, "should be brought back to fight in our region." But over the past few years, Australian troops have been part of some pretty terrible military interventions in the region. The interventions in East Timor, which most recently involved a coup against a democratically elected government that wasn't towing the correct economic line according to the Australian government, was overthrown by the Australian military. And the violent suppression of people fighting for democratic rights in Tonga a few years ago was another result of Australian militarism in the region. All of this is indeed in Australia's national interest, which is to stabilise the region and make it safe for Australian business. So once again, we come back to the heart of the problem. This idea of the national interest is yet another example of how the interests of Parliament and those of business become one under capitalism. The logic of the system, the fundamental dynamics of capitalism, which places the profits of the rich over the interests of the majority, have always, throughout history, reasserted themselves. The problem faced by those who look to the ALP or the Greens to implement radical change is that the capitalist system itself stands in the way of that change. This means that those looking to the ALP or the Greens soon become faced with the question that has emerged time and again. Do you accept the limits imposed on the struggle, or do you go beyond them and question the whole system? Now, I'm not going to go too much into the question of what the alternative is. That's the next session in the foundation stream, so I encourage people to come back to that. But I do want to say that a socialist party brings together those who agree that the problem is capitalism and are prepared to defy its rules, its logic of profit at any cost, and its threats. It organises the most class-conscious, determined fighters so they can build stronger movements. It has to be able to withstand the barrage of abuse from bosses and the media to win arguments with those who waver and understand how to defeat the ruling class and the power it can muster. This party is fundamentally different from those who want parliamentary power because its aim is not to run the system but to destroy it. To reverse the attacks on our rights and conditions, let alone to end the degradation of this society, we need to build a socialist alternative, not just to Labour and the Greens, but to all parties who want a role in managing, in running this horrible system.